Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Forum for Philosophy. Subscribe for weekly discussions of science, culture, politics, and the arts from a philosophical perspective. The Forum is a non-profit organization, and our events are free and open to all. You can support our work via our website and Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to this Forum for Philosophy event, the first one of the new term. My name is Danielle Sands. I'm a fellow at the Forum and I'm going to be chairing this evening's event where we will be asking, what's the point of critique? So we have two speakers this evening. Frida Beckman is Professor of Comparative Literature at Stockholm University, and Tom Boland is Senior Lecturer in Sociology at University College Cork. So Frida, perhaps you could start us off. What is critique and where did it come from?
Well, that's obviously two huge questions, and I think part of our position here will have to be that we cannot answer it, because then we're not doing critique. But I'll give it a go, and I think to first to try to answer the question, what is critique? I presume that an important thing is to try to differentiate between critique and criticism and just being, just not liking stuff or whatever, right? So for something to be critique, I would say that there are two key characteristics. And the first one would be that a critique must also be critical towards its own position, right? So critiquing something, you need to begin also by wondering what you might know. It's a question of judgment and knowledge. Who am I to perform this critique? What do I know about this topic? What prejudice may I have? What knowledge do I have? Do I have maybe a political or religious conviction that it lies behind this? That kind of thing. So critique needs to always to be self-critical as well. And the other point I would like to emphasize is that critique is systematic and tends to look at broader perspectives. So critiquing, for example, I have three teenagers at home, so I know that critiquing or being critical to your parents might be a thing you want to do when you're at that age. Mm-hmm. But for it to be a critique, to not just be angry at your mum for not doing this or doing that, what you could do would be to have a critique of parenthood or motherhood. You would look at the construction of how parents and children are configured at various points in time in terms of power or expectations, gender, whatnot. So that would be a difference then, that it's a critique if you look at not just a single person or a single phenomenon, but also at how that person or phenomenon fits into a larger structure.
Your children sometimes turn around and say things like, so you're merely raising us and giving us food in order that you get the support in your retirement. They unmask you as an exploiter and oppressor of children in their critiques.
Of course, they're raised by academics, so they would of course be prepared to not just be critical of their, when they need to be home at night, but also of what the nature of motherhood and childhood would be.
Yeah. Sorry, is that going too far to start? Thank you. Going too far to start off. Yeah. I mean, to me, there's sort of two meanings of critique, and the Greek thing about kritikos and a judge, and simply to give an appreciation or a criticism that is an evaluation, is relatively unproblematic because we're always evaluating. People are evaluating us right now, or could they have spent their time differently, or is there any point in the philosophy forum or something like that, and being critical, judging things. But then there's that form of critique where you say, well, there's something else going on underneath, and that metaphor of depth, that deep underneath the structures of the LSE, there's an attempt to, I don't know, do whatever.
We are deep underneath the LSE.
Are we?
Literally.
Oh, well, good. Underneath the surface. The surface appearance may be that, you know, such and such is going on, but look, it's actually bourgeois reproduction of knowledge or something like that. And we're very suspicious that something like that is going on. And that's, I think that's where, I don't know, those where critique becomes problematic, is you can't avoid judging. You can't avoid having interpretations or evaluations, but there's a sort of a limitlessness. I mean, if parenthood can't be trusted, and your parents, your children will eventually turn out, I have children too, they haven't done this to me yet, but I'm sure that they will.
Is that going to be the recurring theme of the evening?
I don't know. But you know, if you find that there's a dark conspiracy lurking underneath everything, you know, maybe that's where the problem is and where the limits of critique.
Absolutely, and especially in a context like this, I would say, because for critique, an absolutely central dimension of critique, at least as it's been understood historically and philosophically, is that it needs to be performed in public, and it needs to be a way of thinking together, because you can't do it on your own, because on your own, you're kind of caught up in your own... You can only think. I mean, you can of course evaluate your own thinking, but you need it need for it to always be tested against other people and to be a discussion you have together. So in that sense, that the public and the public sphere is absolutely central. So what you're saying, if there are people here perhaps who would think that maybe this is some kind of conspiracy to brainwash the audience into this or that, then that's a real concern, because if the public space for thinking is infringed, then that would be a real crisis in critique.
So to go back to another big unanswerable question, where does critique come from? What are its origins?
Well, we'd have to begin with Kant, I think, with the Enlightenment and the way he... And it's kind of seen as the beginning of the Enlightenment, so this is 18th century, and the beginning of the modern world, in a way, because Kant had this... It doesn't seem so radical these days, perhaps, but this it was at the time a radical idea that everyone should think for themselves. But also, they should think for themselves, and they need to do it in public. So this was a very important dimension of creating a modern society, that you need to think, but always also interrogate yourself. Then, because if you leave the responsibility for thinking with each of us, then we also need to. We might not be able to get to that perfect truth that God or the king or someone else would represent, because we're faulty and we're human. So it's a very powerful beginning, in a way, of modernity.
It's interesting because, I mean, it's really clear that the Enlightenment is this key time for it. And I would just sort of add to that account this sounds like a critique as I'm doing it, because I'm discovering the secret behind Enlightenment. But what I think is quite important, oddly enough, is religion, even though we usually spend most of our time criticizing religion as a bunch of myths and stories or something like that, and that's you know, maybe the Dawkins kind of it's the God delusion or something like that, and we criticize that as being so silly. And yet, on the other hand, I would think that the weirdest thing is there's nobody so evangelical as the likes of Dawkins, you know, riding around the world with the four horsemen of the apocalypse, convincing people that they're wrong. And that has a distinct religious heritage, because if you go back to the Protestants, they said, you know, we must all think for ourselves, and they criticised the Catholic Church in public, and they had to take that responsibility for forming your own opinion by reading the scriptures yourself, and protesting and making criticisms of the king as part of the English Revolution, to a great extent, less so somewhat the American Revolution. But if you go back even further, if you think of even the word, which is so much, you know, we use this word about every book author, we say an iconoclast. You know, that's what you want on the back of the blurb of your book, right? But iconoclast comes directly from the Old Testament. It means the breaker of images, and that's what Moses and all the chaps out in the desert, as the story goes, they turn up and they say, what are you doing worshipping these myths, these fatted calves or these statues of bulls and so on and so forth? And they said, no, that's rubbish. You've got to get away from that myth and see the real truth. Now, of course, the real truth they were telling was something that was more or less the same thing again, just as much a story as anything else, because it was about a sky god and all this kind of thing. But at the same time, I kind of think that there's an interesting sort of historical entanglement with religion and critique, and especially the zealotry of critique, the demand for revelation, which is again a hugely Christian word. Yeah, I think that's very important.
There is the tension there between critique's attempt to kind of break through dogmatism and this kind of dogmatism that seems to creep back into the critical practice.
Well, I think this might be one of the reasons why people are discussing it today, or people, various academics have been debating whether we should leave critique behind, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that more later, but one of the problems people have identified is that if we end up just performing the same sort of theories, or the same theories that might have been quite critical and important, and they might still be, but if we just perform them without thinking and without continuing, then we're not really critical anymore anyway. So we need to, and it's the same with the in religious context, of course, what you were describing in a way is that the moment you stop and just accept something as if it is your truth, and you're not and you're just going to repeat that viewpoint or that truth, then you lose that constant kind of questioning that critique is. And that would, at least for Kant, would be what we need to do to get close to truth.
Yeah. I would really agree with you that there is a strange sort of thing whereby, when you think about it today, we're educated to be critical, and there's the critical thinking exercises. We're all educated to be logical and rational and think through these things and so on and so forth. And I think that we're almost. You know, you could think about critique as being in itself a story or something, that we're all told that heroic key thinkers at particular times have thought these things, and you can borrow their ideas, and then if you try them on, then you're critical too. And how is that any different from the absorption of any kind of a culture? And yet, you know, it's sort of like the emperor's new clothes. Nobody says to the critic who says Marx was right, or I mean, not that he wasn't or something like that, but you know, it's, yeah, I mean, what if critique was not special, you know, if it was just another identity marker, or just another dogma or something.
But then aren't you talking about it in a specific sense? Because to me it seems like, well, critique, if you think of critique as a particular theory or a particular discipline, then what you're saying applies. But if you think of it as a constant interrogation of what you're doing and what other people are doing, then how can we ever not do that? I mean, that seems like a completely dystopic and terrifying future if we stop doing that. Mm. So in that sense, I don't know how we could be post-critical. That would be like an episode of Black Mirror or something.
I think that's a really significant question, especially thinking about, well, first, the role that critique has played in philosophical history. Is it fair to say that the critique is in some way the kind of the paradigmatic philosophical method?
Yes. There's the whole Greek, apart from the we were doing a little bit of history, it's very popular history, you know, the Old Testament, and then the Greeks and Athens and Socrates and Aristotle with critique sort of a version of it anyway, an interrogation of thought. At the heart of the philosophical enterprise, and that we can't avoid doing that. It's interesting because then we have this phrase, you know, critique, and you know, what is critique, and then we use this phrase, and it means somewhat different things. So if we have the interrogation of our own position as critique, or dialectic, as it was in dialogue in Socrates or something like this, is that the same as all the possible meanings of critique today? Because I mean, so much of the time it seems, and this is a nice Terry Eagleton quote, he says, you know, ideology, it's like bad breath, the other person always has it, not us, you know, and that's the thing. Rather than interrogating our own thought and interrogating our way of thinking as a culture, a lot of the time in critique the drift is towards a sort of more antagonistic interrogation of the other person's position and how they are illogical, and their thought doesn't work out, and they're part of it, and not us. but them, you know. So it's the this other directive. So when you were talking at the start about how it's so important for it to be an internal reflexive is a big buzzword, I suppose, some time ago. But if maybe if we lose that, or if critique becomes less of a philosophical exercise than a politicized or a weaponized, to use that new term, you know, if critique becomes weaponized, then does it lose something of that reflexive character?
Yeah, one of the problems that academics have been discussing is that they're concerned that critique has become some sort of modus operandi in society in general, and that these the fake news and the alternative facts and the post-truth and the kind of systematic deflation of claims, like climate change deniers, where like, oh yeah, we have these facts, but who has produced them? And there is that concern that critique has become a dangerous tool for fearmongers. But to me, it seems like that the enormous difference there is not that I think they have bad breath. Which I might too, but it is precisely that if it's employed as a political tool, then even if it looks like critique because it's some sort of questioning of everything, but it's performed with a particular political agenda, and then it looks like critique, but it isn't.
And that's the tricky thing, is like, how will we tell the difference? Because it's like an almost ancient Greek problem. How will you tell the difference between Socrates and the Sophist? Like, I mean, there's people. Well, I don't know if they're people. They could be bots, for all we know. But when there's a school shooting in America, and it's quite horrific in a certain way, not just climate change denial. As soon as the school shooting happens, people start saying, "No, it's only a hoax. This didn't really happen. The government is trying to make you think this because because they're trying to ban guns or something like that." And instant, you know, and it's clearly politicized. It's quite dystopian in its own way, the limitlessness of the critique run amok, rather than no critique is a terrible thing, but nothing but critique would be a terrible thing. But it is tremendously difficult to discern precisely what would be the politicized critique and what would be the philosophical or the good and bad of critique, and how do you make the difference between those? Because everybody will claim that they are doing the reflexive thought and that the other person isn't. And it's very easy to accuse the other of being politicized in their critical leanings.
I agree with you, but I still think that looking, for example, at these sort of Macedonian troll factories that just keep producing fake news to affect elections or whatever. I mean, that is a systematic. It's not a critique. It's a way of unsettling the conditions for critique. I would say, as I was saying a while ago, the question of the public's fear and what we can know and what we can critique and where. Because if we live in a world where whatever we read, we are critical. We've learned critical thinking, so we're thinking, is this true or not? But obviously, it's come to a point where. Like, so where do we need to read it for us to know that it is the truth, so that we can then proceed to make judgment or perform our critique? So it's certainly a difficult time for critique, even it might always happen.
So just to kind of check in here, it seems to me, Frida, you're saying the problem is not with critique. The problem is labelling things which aren't really critique as critique. And actually those are things which are making critique less possible. Mm. Whereas on the other hand, you seem to be saying, well, maybe the problem is with critique.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair summary. It's, I suppose it's, it depends on the sort of critique, I suppose, because...
And the problem more generally is about kind of political uses of critique and the ends that it's put to.
Yeah, I mean... There's philosophical difficulties with critique as a whole idea, depending on which type we're talking about. Because when you get into sort of the idea of a sort of critique that would unmask and reveal, and that's I think that's we're broadly, I think the left, feminism, civil rights, all these things have been committed to that, the revelation that something else other than what's on the surface is happening. That's been so important politically in modernity. I mean, the effects of socialism, the effects of feminism, we live with them happily today. I think it's a very good thing that those critiques happened. But it's interesting that they happened through a sort of critique that wasn't, it was reflexive, it was public, it existed in probably better conditions of the public sphere with an easier relationship to truth. But it also, it preceded by suggesting that there were deeper structures below the surface. And that is one of the key things that critique in the modern sense, post-Kant, definitely since Marx, really comes back to again and again, that there's an underlying depth. And the problem with that...
And the emancipation comes through exposing that.
Yeah, and the problem with that is the emancipation by exposing is a trope and a story that's borrowed now by, you know, Trump saying big government is bringing us down. There's a left-wing... There, liberal is a good thing. Liberal is sometimes a good thing, sometimes a bad thing, isn't it? It's a bit tricky, isn't it? But that there's a whole liberal conspiracy by the establishment to show this hogwash or this whitewash or this spin and so on and so forth, and that he will tell the truth and reveal the truth. So he's borrowed that story very effectively. And he does it in such a way that it's obviously clownish and stupid. And I mention another leader of a local country who does the same sort of thing, you know, and that's terribly troubling. Now, it would be great if we could decide simply between the good critique and the bad critique. But I think that between, let's say, Donald Trump on the one hand, and I don't know who exactly, maybe Noam Chomsky does it reasonably well as a famous person, you know, but in the in-between, I think it gets quite grey and complicated as different groups do... Where we don't all agree on the political issue, it's very difficult to have a non-contentious definition of critique that'll work very well. Sometimes we often retrospectively rationalise our decisions and say, well, we came to them critically, and we've already made very often our moral or cultural decision on whether or not we value this, that, or the other sort of thing. And probably within this room, because it's a particular kind of room and a particular kind of audience and a particular kind of invitees, we'll probably find that there's a vast range of common ground. But eventually we'll find that there's some level of disagreement on a political or social or cultural or moral issue. And it'll be difficult, I think, if we get to that. We won't come to blows, but we will not easily be able to define which is the critical and which is the non-critical point of view.
But it's also quite important to stick with that grey, complicated... I mean, that is kind of part of the point of critique as well, isn't it? The point of critique cannot be to come up with the final truth or answer. Then it's something else. So precisely we need to, and that's kind of also what we would want to do, is to dig out those differences. I mean, it looks like we're in agreement, but I'm sure Danielle would dig out those differences for us so we can do some hardcore critique here. But I mean, again, it's...
seems to be a slight difference that's coming out in the two types of critique here. So maybe the kind of Trumpian misuse of critique, if you like, does come up with a solution. So it's, yes, look what I found, this is the answer. Whereas the kind of good critique, if we want to call it that, is unfinishable, doesn't have an end, or doesn't have a final end.
Well, if it's, I mean, of course, you're articulating it quite sort of precisely at this point, but maybe that's a good starting point, because it's something to that effect. I don't want to say good and bad or right or wrong in that kind of way, but I do think that once it's turned into a sort of politicized systematic weapon, then it has lost those things that are so central to critique in the first place. So yeah, and then of course there are thinkers of every color and brand that would that would probably be quite dogmatic about their opinion, including of course left-wing, right-wing thinkers in various ways. But of course then maybe what they are doing at a certain point in time is they have a critique, but then they also have a political project that is grounded in that critique. But it's not quite the same as the critique itself. And this is where I'm not sure, I don't know, I don't want to assume things about what Trump thinks about.
Or does he think at all?
Yeah, well, that's how we critique him.
But I mean, like, these are interesting. The kind of to try and make these theoretical or academic or definitional distinctions between these things is quite difficult. And then, you know, to raise a political issue that people will actually disagree about, or that we would actually disagree about. I mean, I don't know. We haven't had known you for only so long. But, you know, say, for instance, an issue which is probably not a widely discussed issue is, for instance, anthropocentrism, or whether or not we should eat other animals and this sort of thing. And you know, maybe we have different points of view on that. And I've eaten some animals this week, you know, and others haven't. Is that something that we could be critical about in terms of looking at its ecological impact? We could look at it in that kind of way. But also somebody could say, well, listen, you know, Tom, you're really sort of anthropocentric. You think that humans matter so much that they should get to eat other animals, and you're okay with that, and that's a problem. And then there's that whole debate. And we don't even need to get to left and right and feminism and things like that before we get to a vegan ecological place of critique, in which we could. And then is it...
I feel like all conversations in January ultimately lead to the vegan question.
I thought it was alcohol.
I'll give you
a left field one, or an unexpected one. There's a political party that says that all humans should be gotten rid of because we're very bad for the planet. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point of view, and they're quite critical, and they say that, you know, we think that we have a God-given right to the earth. Sorry, God-given, as it goes very well actually there, because in the Bible it says that God gave Adam and Eve the world or something like that, right? You know, so is that a myth that we have, that the world belongs to us, that even though we say good thinking and right thinking ecological things, but it's about sustainability. When we say sustainability, we mean for humans. You know, we often don't think about all these species who are going extinct every week or something like that. And therefore we could say, well, shouldn't we unmask each other as being anthropocentric or humanocentric thinkers? Now, would that be that we won't all agree in this room or between each other? Now, not necessarily. I don't have a clear opinion on it, so I don't really necessarily want to have the debate. But if we were to then unmask each other as being anthropocentric, or the other person, I don't know how we could respond to the person who says that. Maybe you could say that they are, you know, a deconstructionist of all culture or something, or a nihilist or something like that, and to accuse and to unmask the other person. I think that that's, from a certain point of view, a problem.
I think that what you're talking about now can also be used as an example of a difference, perhaps, between critique and being and critical, because that example of veganism, for example, or whether you should fly to go abroad on planes, all these discussions that that tend to be at least, I don't know what your Facebook feeds look like, but it tends to be, it becomes more of a personalized sort of accusation. So say, you eat animals, how can you, that kind of thing, where, or you fly and you, and if that is a it's not a critique then, but a questioning of you, then someone has a critical idea about what you're doing. But for it to be a critique, then they need to see how you are just a cog. You're not, like, it's not, your decisions aren't what's going to change the world anyway. So maybe they would rather, if they wanted to perform a proper critique, look at how, who decides on taxes for airplanes, or who decides on the fact that we can raise pigs in factory farming. And, you know, maybe it's, and it's not about not taking responsibility yourself, but still the need to position those decisions in a larger sort of structural framework. That's when it becomes, and that's what I find quite frustrating these days, because it seems like so much of politics among just us regular people is on that sort of small individual level. And then again, it looks like critique, because someone feels so good and political when they say, oh, you eat animals. But they're not really doing that much to change the world.
I just want to pick up on the word that you used, Tom, which I think is really useful here. You said unmasking. And I think one of the challenges that's been pose to critique is this idea that it's a kind of, I think Felsky calls it a chronic negativity. Mm. This idea that it's just negative, it's just judgmental. Sometimes it's kind of triumphalist around it. Maybe this, aha, I've caught you out, you're eating meat. Mm. But is this a fair challenge, do you think? I want to say criticism. This idea that how can you build something using critique if it's just this kind of ongoing negative gesture? Mm.
I think that view, it's a common view that Felsky among others share, but it's a completely mistaken view, actually, because of course on one level it depends to begin with what you mean with negativity, but the point is ultimately, yes, it's about unmasking, it's about looking critically at structures, etc. But ultimately the goal, if it's just about being negative, then that might not be very productive to anyone, but the point of a critique would be to make something better. Mm. Ultimately, if I guess the opposite would be, we see enough of it these days. It's like self-help and mindfulness and positive thinking, as if it. I'm being a bit facetious in a way, but I think it's an important distinction to make that what is being negative versus being positive. So negativity, if critique is negative, which it is on one level, because it's about interrogating and unmasking. Mm. But the ultimate point isn't about just being negative or hoping to pull everything down. And so that it's an important question, I think, and an important point. It's like where you see that negativity, on what level, and what you see it generating or not.
That sort of comes back to your point about the public or the sort or the quality of the public in which critique happens, because if this unmasking, you know, it really does often happen sort of tit for tat, tweedledum, tweedledee. Mm. If you say to somebody, you eat meat or something like that, well, then they'll say, you're a pious liberal who can afford to not eat meat and still have a healthy diet, whereas we, the working classes, or we who are not so privileged as you, and you call the other person out for whatever, and it becomes this arms race of unmasking the other. But it's interesting, because I mean, if we are to say that critique has to have a positive attempt to fix things, attempt to make things better in some way or another, it's it's not an unremitting negativity, but broadly speaking, it sort of seems like negativity first and positivity last chapter of book, you know, where people come in at the end and say, if only there wasn't neoliberalism, then we'd fix this in this way. And they only do it usually at the end. You have, and every now and then you'll get a book that says something like, you know, a whole manifesto for, say, basic income or the 3-day week or something like that, and or sustainability. But broadly speaking, I sort of wandered around a few bookshops today, and you know, shelf after shelf was groaning with the weight of an exposure of this, that, and the other, a deconstruction of our traditional thing of this. You know, it was all about suffering and delusion, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, oppression, domination, injustice, and how people are so ideologically spoon-fed or something, or ideologically brainwashed, that they put up with this kind of thing. And I imagined that they had something positive to say about how things should be done better at the end.
So you're saying that critique has become a sort of default mode?
I suppose it's become endemic. I think as well, I mean, like, there's the way in which it's become almost chronic, and I suppose the nature of the public sphere, not just the adversarialness of Facebook, but politics and the media set up, you know, you have one from the red party, one from the blue party, and you put them to fight with each other, so it becomes endemic in that kind of way. But it's interesting, if you think about the sorts of things that critics or critical theory generally says at the end of it, the great hopes, the great ideals, they're often... This is going to be a critique.
I'll go for it.
But you know, there's an extent to which, you know, say for instance, I mean, to roll back to Kant and his time, the ideals of the French Revolution were like liberty, egality, and fraternity. Now I'm not sure about fraternity, but liberty and egality, they're very interesting sort of like post values. It's like after society, there would be complete liberty, and we would have gotten rid of everything. Everything would be more or less over at that stage, you know, and complete liberty, and then complete equality. Well, you know, what would that be? They're almost like, they're almost like utopian millennial sort of view. So the kind of technical things like a 3-day working week or the welfare state or all of these, you know, these are ways of governing better. And maybe that's, I think, the kind of ideal that we need at the end of critique, is not so much, you know, the big horizon, but the ways of doing things less badly. Mm-hmm. at the least, I don't know, what do you think?
I guess that I agree with you to a point, and I think it must depend a bit on what the starting point is. If your aim with, because I see what you mean in terms of that, like critique is everywhere and everything is just described as sort of unmasking and negative and all that. And if the purpose of that is just to show everyone how bad it is. Mm. You know, then, yeah, maybe that's not, and it's, we're all doomed, then it is no point. But at least in the tradition of critique, and now I'm thinking maybe also of the Frankfurt School thinkers of the 20, 30, 40s, where, like, so there was a very strong critique of the way society was developing. Mm. But that was also performed with a very strong hope that it could be different. And it certainly took a blow in the 40s, but they kept going, you know, like so there is a way in which you, well, most of them, in which you need to keep believing, in a sense, and that critique is also a utopian gesture in a way.
But I think that's partly what you're criticizing, that it's too utopian. Mm-hmm. That actually, if you're too utopian, then you don't fix the broken door or whatever. You're looking up there and you don't fix the current problems. Mm. Is that, am I?
I think, I mean, I'm not even sure what my opinion is. I sort of sometimes criticise myself, and I'm not too sure, because I can see that there's an attraction and a difficulty with almost all of the things we could say about critique, and it's the interesting thing about the, you know, there's the utopian gesture, and I think that maybe that's can be a problem in itself, because it almost expects too much, or it expects a post-social, post-cultural, post, almost, you know, post-revolutionary. So nothing in the interim is ever good enough, so we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the better, or something like that. But on the other hand, it's interesting when you say we must believe in critique, we must keep, you know, it's like we must keep faith with critique, which is quite a peculiar thing, because what is it if we're all critics now? And, you know, when you ask, I ask sometimes my classes, you know, who here is a pawn and a dupe? And nobody puts up their hand, you know, and who here is easily led? And all the clever people then put up their hand, because then, ah, ha, ha, you know, they have shown that they are the people who think for themselves, something like that. Maybe if we're to all be critics, well, what is that in itself?
Then it's important to go back to those distinctions that I was trying to make in the beginning as well, because, yeah, we're all critics. That's not the same as believing in critique. Because being all critics, then, yeah, that maybe that is about just being negative, or just trying to defend your own stance, whatever that might be. So that's not what I'm trying to believe in. Mm. I'm not sure that's a very positive development at all. Quite on the contrary, it would be better if more people were just quiet and thought about it and maybe worked. I mean, I'm not saying everyone should be quiet, but like not just automatically reacting in the way you would, because you're you, right? I'm thinking of, again, all these heated conversations, if you can even call them conversations, on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Most of the time, that's not about critique in the sense that people have thought very carefully about the whole, taking in the whole picture, and they are pursuing a project that they hope will be generating good things in the future. It's about saying, you know, I'm better than you because I don't eat meat. So it's really important to keep that in mind. I think that at least when I that the distinction between critique and everyone being critics.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting, because this. The position, you know, you begin to take is on the one hand, philosophically, I see all these kind of problems with critique, and yet I do critique. I principally, I have sort of a bifurcated sort of world. So I do the sociology of critique and complex philosophical questions about that. And on the other hand, I do the sociology of welfare and social policy and things like that. So I try to write things criticising the drift of welfare policy and saying we can do these things differently. And how could I possibly do that if I didn't believe in critique? Because I'm, but the interesting part of what I find is important about that is you can criticize, say, for instance, I'm not sure if everybody thrilled and excited by welfare policy, but we all know that it's become much harsher than it used to be, and that the welfare state is beginning to be dismantled in various ways. So you can criticize that and say that's a tremendously negative neoliberal development, and you can say that's based on the mythology of the importance of work, or the mythology of the sponger or the shirker, and you can do all that critical work, and that's very important. But it's interesting, in order to persuade people to do things differently, you also, I think, have to offer them some sorts of ideals. And so in that, you know, your ideas are things like solidarity and care and tolerance and respect for people's different decisions, which are, some of them are a bit socialist, some of them are slightly liberal, but they're all ideals. So I think that maybe we're getting around to the thing that you can't be just a critic, but you must be a critic, but also have clear, and they're always culturally specific ideals. They're not post-cultural or non-cultural. So I think critics need, if they're going to be good critics, maybe they need some sort of ideas. But don't all the alt-right and the Trumps and the Johnsons and all these, and the Bolsonaros, don't they have their ideals too? Mm-hmm. So back in confusion again.
But I think it's a very important thing to also keep in mind what you're saying in terms of a critique, that we can't have just critique. I mean, there must be also that, and I don't see a contradiction. I think that's what you're saying as well.
Oh, absolutely.
For someone to do research into the possibility of having a 3-day working week, they must also, I mean, maybe not themselves, but it must be grounded in some kind of critique of the way society and the working week looks now, and why that's bad for people, and why all those things that need to be it's a kind of groundwork for then maybe having those constructive suggestions. Mm. So again, it seems like it's not about having critique or not having critique. It must be about having those different dimensions of working towards a better life, a better society, work together in different ways.
Mm. But then is there anything special about the critic or the critique? Because for certain liberal thinkers, we live in a plural public and everybody has their different point of view. And none of them are particularly special because everybody has their own ideological or political commitments. And so is there any particular role for critique in that? And the problem with unmasking critique then is that you don't really talk to the other, you just say your opinions are based on bad faith or being duped by whatever it is. So in a way, is critique a problem because it erodes those particular clear ideas and commitments?
But then you're talking about everyone being critics again rather than critique, I think, because that's what we were saying a little while back, that someone just accusing you of killing animals, that is being critical and taking a position where you feel that you are, or that other person is, feels themselves to be better in various ways. But again, I think that is quite different from, because if that person was ready, again, to see you as maybe a pawn or a dupe or whatever of those larger structures, ideological, economic, all those cultural, then maybe that would be the starting point of critique.
Mm. Yeah, I think what was interesting here, if I'm understanding you right, we're sort of deflating critique down from its godlike position to being just a sort of ordinary rumination and reflexivity. And then by and large, people who are designating their work as a critique of, you know, they don't mean to say just I did a lot of rumination and reflexivity, and I've thought about it a lot. They usually claim more than that, in order to take some sort of political advantage. Mm. But so is it that we need to find the limits of critique and downsize all of these extraordinary claims? Mm. Maybe critique needs to retreat to be just ordinary again.
Yes, and in a way, I think it's very important not to see, because I think that's a problem with the debates today, that critique has become one thing that is associated with a certain set of thinkers, and and there are certain people who have done it, and now people are saying we're not going to be like those people. So it becomes this kind of quite, it's both vague and too specific at the same time, because they've constructed a conception of critique that is way too specific to be critical, I suppose. But then you also need, and I think this is an interesting, going back for a moment to the historical development as well, because as I mentioned before, for Kant, this is critique was very much, I mean, it started really in each individual. But then as soon as we get to Hegel, then that becomes more of a way in which we then see, of course, in Marx, it becomes a structured way of looking at an engagement for improving society on a large scale. So it becomes a more organized project in that way. And I don't know if we take then a huge jump to the present where the focus on individuals and individual responsibility has almost disabled us from engaging, from seeing ourselves not just as we don't see ourselves as cogs so much as we see ourselves as having this endless responsibility that make us feel ashamed and guilty for eating animals or flying planes, or because as if our individual decisions will make such a huge difference. And if we could harness that in a positive way, see ourselves as cogs in a system in a positive way, that would also mean that we might see find reason to engage on a broader level, engage in whatever political party we might sympathize with or group together and go out on the streets. I don't know, now I'm being really utopian, but still that there is that I think we need to find our way back to that sense in which we are individuals as part of a larger structure, and it's only then that critique can be critique.
What you're saying is really fascinating, because then you begin to say, well, maybe if we shouldn't say one critique, there isn't a critique with a capital C. There's many critiques, and there's maybe, you know, there's, we were talking about paranoid thinking and suspicious thinking and conspiracy thinking, and those might be problematic forms of critique. And then there might be, you know, relentless, ironic, deconstructive criticism. Oh, it's all made up, it's all stories. And that, where does that leave you? Well, the pragmatic question in philosophy is, like, something only matters as an idea insofar as it has consequences. And, what forms of critique then make a difference to society and politics? Well, those must be ones that are in some way or another connected to doing things differently or pursuing different possible ideals or different sorts of reforms. You know, maybe pursuing revolution might be one of them. I'm not sure that sometimes has mixed results or something, but, you know, reforming critiques rather than tremendously demanding total change or something like that. And then I don't know, forms of critique which are, you know, maybe less recognized by us, or something like the forms of critique which say something like, well, couldn't we have better connections, or, you know, critiques that come with a warm and fuzzy glow about them, or something like that.
So is this potentially one way of kind of combating the challenge that critique is this big monolithic force, and it is the single philosophical method, and all of the kind of Eurocentric heritage of that thinking? Is thinking more pluralistically about critique one response to those kind of challenges?
Well, I think one we could start up from where we are right here, right now, and we come from two different disciplines, sociology and literature, and critique has been used to describe partly different theoretical efforts. And I think we've established that they have the same starting points to some extent, but they're also different practices that apply differently to different types of contexts. So yes, of course there must be different critiques rather than one critique.
I've already done Eurocentricism here, because I've done Greece and Israel, even though that's really the edges of Europe. There is I think it's Talal Asad, I I have the correct name, who has this interesting book with Judith Butler, in which she says, well, look at the Islamic sources of critique, and, you know, look at those different forms. And I'm from Ireland, and people there do claim occasionally that there's a different form of criticism in its poetry and in its political tradition, such as that exists at all, or that we have records of it.
I've been thinking that perhaps what's happening now can also be compared to a critique that feminists had back in the 90s, where, I don't know how familiar everyone is with this, but there was one of the largest topics of humanities studies was a question of the subject. Who is the subject, deconstruct the subject, etc. A real strong questioning of the nature of the subject, which was important. And feminists said, oh, isn't this funny, that just when women are actually gaining that subject position, that's when we have to start critiquing it and deconstructing it. And then eventually there were ways of developing theories, that strong feminist theories that could make good use of that critique of the subject. But still, there was that sense in which, oh, just because you guys have always had the subject position, now feel that you need to question it. And and I wanted to maybe just test that comparison with the crisis in critique today, in a way, because I've also noted that there are several people working in various, working with the resistance movements in South America or in Palestine, and people said, who have been quite upset with people like us talking about the crisis in critique, because they feel like they're doing fantastic, important work where they are actually gaining some tractions. I mean, we might not see it because it's not on, but there are still quite active efforts of critique that might not fit into our Eurocentric conception of it. So this might be important to keep in mind, that, yeah, maybe there is a crisis in the way we've been using it or looking at it, but there are other things that we might not see.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting when you look at the history of words and concepts and master concepts, like in the Romantic era, I suppose, people, the meaning and the value attached to words like sensibility and rationality, they wavered back and forth, and every now and then, you know, there was a sort of mass, you know, rejection of reason and rationality, and yet here we are today, and those are still, you know, I mean, if there is a globe to look back in 100 years' time to say, look at that, they had a problem with critique back in the early 2020s or something like that. It was, you know, and then they had that classic work, and then they realised that they were all wrong, and then they were post-critic or something like that, and they have some fancy words, and they look back and they say, well, they just had a problem with their vocabulary. They're trying to talk about different things or something like that. But I think that the crisis of critique comes, and this is, I suppose, reflecting that I'm from sociology. The strong feeling in sociology, I suppose, was that critique had been co-opted and stolen by others to whom who weren't doing it right as such, that advertisers were borrowing critique to sell us clothes and soft drinks, that managers were borrowing critique to somehow or other persuade their workers that they were working in a really cool and edgy firm and you only had a six-month contract, but it was cool and you were free or something like that. And that sort of co-opting of critique by capitalism, and also it's, you know, much more apparent today, I think, is the sense that critique is in crisis because it's been politically co-opted. You know, I mean, who does critique nowadays? Everybody, including the alt-right, the feminists, the neo-Nazis, the fascists, and they talk about, you know, they borrow the same sort of conspiratorial language about, you know, I suppose, that we've been talking about so far, the unmasking, the conspiracy. There's neo-Nazis. The Charlottesville in 2017, just after Trump, was, they had a Unite the Right rally. A chap turned up at that, and his thing was that he was the radical agenda, and his radical agenda was to stop the genocide in America, which was moving all the white people out, which is not happening anywhere. You know, this is not happening. There's no. This is not a real thing. But he said, you know, We're going to spread these ideas. We're going to have the free speech. We're going to have the public stage to say this, which is so much forbidden to us because we're so radical. They can't handle us. These people stealing critique and making it into all kinds of things. That's what I think is the reason for the crisis and critique.
I wonder whether now might be a good time to start taking some questions. Yep, that's true.
Thank you very much for the discussion. In a digital time where kind of everyone can be a critic today, and they can be there in a kind of limitless public forum wherever they feel like doing that on a daily basis, everyone can kind of always find an audience for whatever they want to critique and have a debate about. But often they really do that with like-minded people. And kind of what I'm wondering about is how could each of us kind of contribute, where that's the case today, in learning how we adapt to such a conditioning that happens all around us 24/7, which is really unfamiliar, right? We haven't had that in human history, where day to day, everyone within this lecture happening can start a debate in the meantime happening next to us. That wasn't possible, right, in the last century. So it's still very new to us. So yeah, how can we contribute to making that better?
Yeah, it's a very good question and a really important one, of course. And I can't presume to have the perfect answer. I would love to save the world right now. But to me, it seems like a crucial thing is, first of all, to acknowledge this, as you're doing now, to see that this is a problem, because we might forget. We might forget that it's a problem. We might forget that all that input we get all the time and all those heated discussions are maybe not where we should be directing our attention. Maybe we should not. And I mean, a few maybe concrete suggestions would be to just like, don't get your news from Facebook, you know, like don't like subscribe to a few magazines. You know, read like, and including some coming from a from a different political perspective than what you might sympathize with. I mean, I know it's banal, perhaps, but I do think, and some people have been suggesting that this whole like thing where we're all on social media all the time might just pass. We might actually. At least, I don't know what it's like here, but in Sweden, quite a few have gone like, I'm tired of that. I'm going to go back to reading my paper in the morning. You know, that it's been so, especially for our generation, where it's been a new thing, so it's been so very exciting. But anyway, that sense in which we, because I think this is really when our idea of ourselves as rational subjects have been taken a blow, where we kind of pulled into this constant, stimulation that stops us from.
Isn't it precisely like what you were saying about the public? Because it's like if you have in your pocket at any moment a whole audience to argue with, then your every thought, your boundary, and it was always a construct, this boundary or whatever, and it was always problematic in various ways, but your whole life becomes a constant publicness, and that means that you're constantly exposed to sort of a demand for critique, or you're exposed to the possibility of being critiqued at any moment. So it's an unlimiting, as you were saying, anyway.
It is, but still maybe not very productive or do much for you or the other people, because it looks sincere perhaps, but it's constant. I mean, maybe you're exhausted. Like if you've been arguing with people on Twitter all day, maybe you're not going to be reading that book about, I don't know, Kant. Not Kant. You don't have to read Kant.
Let's take another question. There's one up there.
You've been talking a lot about critique and crisis. And now what I find very funny is that the words crisis and critique are both derived from the Greek krinein. And krinein means to determine, to differentiate, to separate things. And crisis was originally, I think it meant something like, I don't know, a moment in which things get determined, like decisive moment, something like that. So it seems as if there can't be any critique without crisis. So any critique is always in crisis because it points towards a crisis. Or otherwise, like the other way around, perhaps crisis just means, or if we perceive something as crisis, it means that we think we always need to determine something. Something needs to be differentiated right now or judged or separated. So is this perhaps also an illusion? Do we always need to determine things? Or can there be a critique without crisis?
I mean, didn't Kant, it's interesting because, I mean, on the one hand, etymologically, yeah, that is spot on. But the interesting thing is and of course, how do we know? How do we determine this? But isn't it Kant who said, you know, we live it, today is the great age of critique, and to critique, everything must submit. And I don't know, did Google do a nice little graph of how often these words are used? So the word pop, and there's different meanings to them, but you know, there's an almost it's a growth industry, as it were. You know, unmasking, critique, deconstruction. It's more and more frequent, and now, and that's a very crude measure. But if you look at where do we give training in critique? It used to be a final year undergrad or something like that, but now it's first year, and now we are into schools and in kindergartens, people must be given critical thinking. So you know, maybe yes, it was always thus to a certain extent that there's some sort of amount of critique, but only in times of crisis or only now and then. But now all the time, like the phone in the pocket and the public sphere in the pocket, always crisis, always critique. I think that's exhausting. Yeah,
and I think there is something fundamentally, I mean, it's important and quite beautiful about that connection between crisis and critique, because it means the way I see it is also because if we take that seriously, then we see that the responsibility we are given as subjects of any society at any one time must be to realize that we are faulty thinkers, but we have to keep trying. It is a crisis in that we can't rely on anyone else to know better necessarily. We have to keep or to tell us the truth. It would be so nice that Kant talks about that as well. How lazy we tend to be. How comfortable it is to subscribe to someone else's truth. So that it is a crisis. It's hard work to be to both get that responsibility of critical thinking and to know that you're never going to do it well enough, but you have to keep trying. So yes, I think it's not a problem but a possibility with a combination of crisis and critique.
Thank you very much. I just want to add to the previous person who asked the question. Maybe we should approach critique from different perspective. Perhaps critique is a part of the nature, our human nature and nature as a whole. Heraclitus, a Greek philosopher, said, "Pantarei, everything is moving." Perhaps without the critique, we wouldn't be able to move. We can observe this on our individual development as a child. Children have natural curiosity. They said that children are philosophers, natural philosophers. And of course, then during the development, we can achieve the higher stage, which is a critique, somehow more conscious, critical approach to life and everything around us. And the same as a humanity, we are developing from the early stages of criticizing everything to the critique, Kant, and of course, we have lots of things to develop more. So it's part of our nature. It's like a driving force to move, to develop to another stage of our being.
It would be good to keep with that thought. I mean, it seems like you almost lose hope sometimes, because it seems like some are quite comfortable not challenging themselves or others. Well, I think most people are comfortable challenging others, but not themselves so much, perhaps. But I think you're right. Ultimately, if we all could see that as part of who we are, rather than as being a particular kind of person, and that it's absolutely necessary for ourselves as individuals and as society and history to proceed, to have that. It's a driving force. That's what you're suggesting.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think, I mean, I don't know about nature, but you know, because I mean, do ants criticize? Do you know?
Nature is a crisis is within nature. It was said that critique is connected to crises, and when we know the history of humanity, the world, we can notice there were crises during this process.
I suppose, I mean, it's interesting because it's like we couldn't disagree that thought is necessary, but would it have to be critical thought? And what sort of critical thought would be useful and positive, and how much of it could be potentially negative? Because we're obviously looking at the downside, so there must be some way in which we must make some distinctions in this way. But you're right, there's no there is no way out of thinking, you know, so we have to, in this way, take responsibility for ourselves.
Well, again, thank you for very much for the discussion today. You know, perhaps it's a little ironic that tonight is the first time I've ever stopped to question the idea of critique. My question, or the thing I'm curious about, is critique necessarily positivistic in its approach? In other words, is there necessarily some kind of truth to be unmasked through critique?
That's a lovely question. I really appreciate that, because I can see why you would ask that. But most, at least in the past 100 years or so, I think would say that it's absolutely not positivistic. That's exactly its point, in a way, that there isn't a truth out there or under there or whatever, when we are masking, that we can hope to find. And that again is why critique needs to be a constant feature, because it's about getting closer to it rather than finding it for good, in a way. So in that sense, and maybe that is an important distinction as well that we can make between those. You've been talking a lot about those types of critique that have been co-opted by different politics and all that. That it's quite essential to keep that doubt as a starting point.
It's interesting because most academic versions of critique are not naively positivistic, but on the other hand, they do tend to sort of have an idea of error or falsity or myth or ideology or something like that at heart in them. So they're always moving away from these things, but not necessarily arriving at a positivistic model of the truth. But they're moving away, and this is again another sort of negativity. And maybe I'm.
Well, I don't think it has to be. I'm thinking of Samuel Beckett, failing better. You have to keep trying, and you're going to fail, but you can fail maybe better next time. That there is something and that is actually, it seems, I think, quite silly to speak of positive and negative, but there is still, the idea of failing better is kind of a positive one, not a positivist one, by the way.
But surely it makes the relationship between critique and liberation or emancipation much more difficult to negotiate, because if you think about kind of modern critique, the idea that there was some kind of truth to be unmasked, and in that unmasking, someone is liberated or something becomes clear that enables something. If you then move to a postmodern model, if you like, where there is no clear truth to be unmasked, then it seems much more difficult to map the kind of emancipatory potential of that, doesn't it?
I don't think so. I know that there are a lot of people who would say that, but I certainly wouldn't, because it seems to me that there is no contradiction in trying, so say, emancipation, whether it's women or people of colour or working class, whatever perspective you want to take, or all of them for that matter. If we believe that there was a point in which that has been perfected, I mean, that would be like kind of the truth or the ultimate. Like that then we're finished. We're done. We have the perfect society. That we might, even if we don't think that we will come to that point, that doesn't prevent us from feeling that it's absolutely crucial that we keep trying, right? Mm. We have to keep trying for the best of possible worlds, even if it's never going to be perfect. And I see that striving towards truth, or as close to truth as we can get, as the same thing. It's not about denying truth, or it's like it doesn't matter. That's the kind of caricature of postmodern theory, in a way, that it's all relative and it doesn't really matter, we can say whatever we want. That's not it at all, but it's rather about, because we know it's very hard to get at, we need to make sure that we get as full a picture of it as we can, and then we need to take in all these different perspectives and problematize it and unmask it in different ways.
I mean, isn't it less about a positivistic epistemic view of the truth, as in a good scientific map of reality, as it is a matter of moving towards ideals? I mean, you could have, you know, a great but immoral or intolerable and perfectly rational and perfectly perfect survival strategy for the climate catastrophe we're facing, in which you don't really care about everybody else, but usually in critique, it's not a matter of moving to New Zealand or moving to a bunker or something like that. It's not about the facts and it's surely about ideals again. So I mean, I think the critique doesn't have to have a positivistic horizon, but in order for it to be anything better than deconstructive postmodernism, and I know that's a caricature again, mm-hmm. but that relentless unmasking or the negative critique, it has to have an ideal to orient to, mm-hmm. and so we're back to the positive and the positivist again. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
And maybe this is a time to say also that, I mean, I feel like I've taken the position here of being the
defender of critique.
Defender of critique. But of course, I think I'm happy with that, but there is still, of course, there are different ways of doing critique, just as there are different postmodern theories, and I'm not suggesting that it's all, like, all of it is good. That's not my point at all. And of course, there are those who are relentlessly negative or negativistic in a way that is not productive, or who are so relativistic that nothing becomes possible, and that's not the ideal. I mean, I think it's a very important point that came up now in response to this question that we need to, it needs to be about us striving towards something better or closer to good or closer to true, the truth.
Firstly, a very big thank you for coming out to talk to us tonight. I wanted to build on a notion that was talked about, the fact that critique is something that keeps humanity moving, especially if considering what you've just talked about just now, the sense of what do we do in a situation where this unmasking has happened, the critique has been applied, and it's more or less universally acknowledged to be truthful or positive in a sense, but is neglected, and the most prominent situation of this would be the climate change scenario.
Is that the tragedy of critique or something like that? That, and of course we can go back to something like saying quite easily, as I'm sure most of us in this room agree, that the climate skepticism is a not good, am I allowed to curse? Anyway, you know, it's not a good version of critique, but the tragedy of critique is critique is so easily, well, not so easily, but it has been unfortunately imitated and put to other uses. And rather than just only delivering to us ideals or liberation or equality, it has also delivered to us, you know, confusion, relativism, and an antagonistic public sphere. So does that mean that we need to do critique better or something? And I'm not sure am I the attacker against critique, but the reformer of critique or something like that? Or the, I don't know, I have a sort of tragic view of critique, that eventually the result of critique, if you follow it in a certain way, is that, you know, we are on a planet made out of dust, and we will eventually go extinct, and we are just a load of chemicals, and therefore nothing means anything, so you may as well enjoy yourself or something like that. But there's certainly no meaning to any of these relationships that we have in any way. But you know, so what? So what? But tragically, the results of critique are very mixed.
I just realized, which I'm kind of ashamed to realize, that we're talking about critique for nearly 1.5 hours, and we haven't mentioned the word power even once, I don't think, which is quite shocking. I'm so sorry. and the reason why I think of it now, I think, is because of this question, because, yes, if there is... At all points, there is the question of whose interest is it? In whose interest is it to question a particular fact or a particular viewpoint? And that there, I mean, again, the climate change question is kind of a perfect one, or a perfect example here, because it is, on the one hand, not a truth universally acknowledged, as Jane Austen would say, but it's quite a few of us who are quite confident in that climate change is a real thing. But those who there are so such strong powers interested in denying that and pursuing that those kinds of conspiracy theories or that false type of critique to undermine this this conception. And to me, it's not so much about believing or not believing. It's about the about power and mm-hmm. about why we should or shouldn't subscribe to something and who gets to decide.
There are a couple of questions towards the back.
In the blurb to your theme of tonight, you ask whether it's possible to embrace different ways of thinking. What exactly do you mean by different ways of thinking? Isn't thinking itself, by definition, critical? What is different ways?
Thank you. And can we take one more as well, please? Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much. Really interesting. I just want to say, in all this kind of stuff saying about the stuff about unmasking and all that kind of stuff, that actually it's not about the critique and the kind of how sad that is. What's sad is that we're not allowed to have doubt. And all the problems that have come, whether you're talking about climate skeptics or whatever, the critique that they use is that it's not a definitive answer. And what we have to make fashionable again is that nuance and doubt, that's the beautiful thing. That's the beautiful thing. That's the truth for us. For us to be able to elevate that again, there's nothing more frightening than the people who have complete certainty on their side. And I think historically, the people who've been so certain of everything have caused the most amount of trouble and wars and all the rest of it. And at the moment, we've got very populist leaders that are very certain about their critique. So I think to what you were saying, the quote from Samuel Beckett, to actually kind of elevate nuance and doubt and actually make that an interesting and beautiful thing for humanity, something that people should be proud of and not ashamed of.
Wonderful, that's beautifully put, and that's kind of what I was trying to articulate before as well in response to this question from the front, that there is something, it's we live with the I think a dangerous idea again that we can only act on something if we know for certain and we know the truth, and that doubt is dangerous, and therefore we must subscribe to something, and that in that sense this positivist idea. I mean, most people accuse postmodernist theorists or others for doubt people in doubt for undermining the possibility for change. But as you say, there. To me, it seems like that is the opening to change as well. Yes. Absolutely. And as for the other question, I don't know if we can think differently from. I don't know if you.
I mean, it depends, because I mean, on the one hand, we could say that all thinking is critique because we're making judgments and making perceptions at certain. But there are, we could surely distinguish between, you know. Thinking which is more interpretive, it's about understanding culture and understanding meaning or something like that, and then critique would be more involved in judging and sort of more, it could be a harsher kind of, I don't know, is that a well-standing decision? But also, ultimately, even though we have our doubts, there's also that sort of thinking which is, you know, there's a kind of emotional embrace of certain things, that we have convictions, you know. I don't think it's not easy to be involved in politics without having a conviction that your way is in some way either right or good. So I mean, I as I was saying, I do welfare reform and unemployment. I have, you know, I could spend a lot of time criticizing myself, and I do spend a certain amount of time certainly in doubt. But eventually, I have to turn up and say, this is how it is, and thump the table and say, you know, and so that kind of thought. So maybe affirmative thinking. Or that sort of turn towards emotion. But even then, if you think about the way in which we relate to politics, we criticize people, and sometimes then they become our enemies, and this is maybe back to this unmasking, this antagonism. But maybe there's a better way to relate to that, in which we acknowledge that, you know, people believe things for their reasons, they've grown up believing these sort of things, and if we simply criticize them, well then we're just going to have an entrenched arms race of critique. Whereas if you could, on the other hand, say people, I know why you think this, I understand, and that's a bit patronizing already, but still, I understand you think this, and these are your values, and ultimately this, that, the other. How could, let us say us on the liberal left or something, make friends with the American Christian right in the South or something like this? How could that be possible? Well, will we enlighten them? Will we criticize them until it is exposed to them how stupid they are? in some way or another, you must be able to find common ground with them. And if you could probably quote the Bible to them and point out that actually they're not in favor of inequality in the Bible. See, you know, or something like that. That might work. I don't know.
I think a dream of a critique would also be the possibility of not just the deciding who's right, but to have those kinds of constant conversations where you have to not just try to win the argument, but to, as you say, to listen, to engage, to try, really try to understand rather than just dismiss other people's opinions and viewpoints. And also, again, as you say, lift them to a higher level, what is not just about that individual being stupid, but about a whole society in which the background, the ideology, the culture, whatever, has affected them, as they have, of course, yourself. So again, you need to take that into account as well. But ultimately, it's thinking together. And yeah, again, you need to do that with the people you don't agree with as well, of course.
I think that's a nice note to finish on. We are out of time. Thank you very much for coming. Do join us next week when we are talking about peace. And join me in thanking our speakers.